The Manjushri in person, Lama Tsongkhapa, has said in the lineage Lama prayer of Lamrim. He refers to Adisha and the drum tempa as the two ornaments of the world. So at the time of Lama Tsongkhapa writing this, of course, we didn't know the world at large as such, as we know now today. But and the Buddha has not the Buddhism has not also spread as widely as it has now. And today, but today, all over the world, the people have taken are taking interest in the profound and the extensive paths or teachings of the Buddha, and therefore we can say they are the two ornaments of the world. And so he says, Adisha, holder of the tradition of the great vehicle, who saw the profound dependent arising just as it is. So dependent origination is one of the best means to explain the external phenomena on the ground level, the basis level or the ground level of the reality. And so he practiced this profound dependent origination and philosophical view, and also taught this to others, and therefore his enlightened activities spread. And so with regard to the Lamrim, the lamp for the path of enlightenment, so Dromtenpa has said, so this rosary of Kadam lineage can be very beneficial for anyone who sends the beads. And so the teaching of the Buddha, comprising of the philosophical view of dependent origination and the ethical conduct of not harming other sentient beings or non-violence, as I quoted before, the Buddha showed the path as he has seen it, and so following him will actually let us fulfill all our goals. And so the Buddha became an enlightened one and is dedicated to the welfare of other sentient beings, all other sentient beings. And so he taught according to the needs of the different sentient beings, their predispositions. And so the teaching of the Buddha is such that it helps all types of beings according to their needs. And so, ka dam, ka here is has the meaning of the words of the Buddha, dam has the meaning of instruction, of that which is put in accordance with the pertaining to the three types of beings of three capacities, and therefore such is the teaching of the tradition of Master Adisha. And therefore, if you engage in the study, reflection, and meditation on such a teaching with this high rebirth of a so this leads you to attain such a rebirth with of high status. And having found that, then you cultivate renunciation or the determination to be free from samsara. And then you also could think that other sentient beings are in the same boat as you are, but full of suffering. And the causes of suffering, which are the afflictive emotions, the negative thoughts and emotions. And you would think of liberating all sentient beings as well. And therefore, whether you aspire to higher rebirth, or the highest state of omniscience, the London or lamb for the path to enlightenment, shows the path that leads you to be born in higher status, higher rebirths, and the means to leading to that as well. And therefore, the practice of this teaching leads you to a state which is free from the intense the suffering of pain or suffering of suffering, and also the change of the suffering. And then you have the teachings on the three trainings, which lead you to out of samsara. And then when you think of actually helping others, then it also leads you to cultivate this spirit of enlightenment, which thinks of benefiting all sentient beings, and which would lead you to the highest goal of enlightenment. And so, therefore, this Lam Rim teaching has the capacity to, the potential to lead you to all these three goals of higher rebirths for those who are of lower capacity, and for those who are of the medium capacity, it would lead you to the state of liberation. And then for those who are of highest capacity, it would lead you to the highest goal of enlightenment, omniscient state. And therefore, Dhamdunpa says, this rosary of the Kadam teaching, the Ka referring to the Buddha's words, and then Dham in the instructions for the three types of beings of three capacities, is going to be beneficial, whoever sends the beads of it. And so, after the Adisha's text, Lama Tsongkhapa wrote his great Lam Rim and medium Lam Rim, and then the others. And then following that, the first commentary to the Lama Tsongkhapa's Lam Rim is the third Dalai Lama's, the third Dalai Lama's, the essence of refined gold. And then the fifth Dalai Lama's, the sacred words of Manjushri. And then there is the Lhoyu Lam Rim, the southern Lam Rim tradition. And then we have the Benjen Lobsang Yishi's swift path. And before that, we have the Dagpo Gomchen's Lam Rim, Leksung Nyingkhu, the quintessence of wisdom words. And then we have the essence of nectar, which is very good for our daily use for meditation and visualizations. And then we have the 13 Dalai Lama's one who from whom the 13 Dalai Lama receives teachings, Shamar Gendun Tenzin, from Amdo. So we have Shamar Lam Rim, written by Shamar Gendun Tenzin. It's not very extensive text, but he makes he clarifies points which are very crucial. So we have the Shamar Lam Rim, and then our master of the Lam Rim tradition, and my master, my main master from whom I have received the Lam Rim teachings and instructions, and Gyabjit Jarum, which is notes on the teachings of Lam Rim by Gyabjit Pabongka Rinpoche, which is the text is the liberation in the palm of your hands. So I have received the instruction of this. So all these texts are put together by Ling Rinpoche and Chokchu Rinpoche, together in five books in Tibetan. So as I said in the beginning of the teaching in Galden, so those who have come here, I thought that it would be good to do the Lam Rim Chemo and the Middle Lam Rim, and also the Song of Experience, and then also the I also have the wish to also do the outlines of the Lamrim Dingbo, the middle and Lamrim put together by Tijan Rinpoche at some point of time. So in this way, we, those who have come to this to the teaching this time will have at least the teaching of the complete set of some of the books out of the 18 different Lamrim texts that we are going to go through. So we have finished with Mare Svatsar. So we are on patience. So the divisions of patience. So those who are who have anger, those who are angry, actually forsake the benefiting the thought of benefiting others. So we are in middle length Lamrim, actually on patience. Joseph Marek did it. No. Sorry to train in the, how to train the patience, the entity or the nature of patience. The entity of patience is the mind abiding at ease without being overwhelmed by harm and the occurrence of suffering, as well as very abiding dedication to the Dharma. Its opposites are hatred, disheartenment, lack of opposition, lack of desire. And the completion of the perfection of patience is the mere complete familiarity with mind, of the mind with seizing one's own belligerence and so forth. It does not depend on freeing other sentient beings from their unruliness. Its divisions, there is a patience of not paying heed to harm by others, by the patience of accepting the suffering that arises in one's own continuum, and the patience of mind of a mind certain with respect to the Dharma. With regard to how to generate patience in one's continuum, you think about the fact that the 181, page 181, of middle length Lamrim, you think about the fact that later on you will have few enemies, you will not be separated from the dear ones, you will experience much happiness and mental happiness, you will die without regret, and you will be reborn among the gods after this body has perished. In the compendium of the perfections, it says, for those with a mind that neglects the welfare of others, it was taught, the best of ways is patience. That which is good and excellent in the world, patience protects it from the faults of anger. It is the best of ornaments of the strong peak of power for those embracing austerity, torrent of water for primary fires of malice. All harm is removed by patience in this life and others. Against the armor of patience of excellent beings, the arrows of words of unruly beings are wrecked. Thereby, they turn into excellent flowers of praise and become attractive garlands of fame. And fame is also the workshop where forms are accomplished with beautiful qualities and adorned with the signs. You should meditate on the advantages as taught here until you reach a strong and stable certainty with regard to them. And then the disadvantages of impatience, invisible disadvantages and visible disadvantages, along with supplementary remarks. So with regard to the first one, there are four points. How anger destroys the roots of virtue, how they are destroyed even if the object of anger is an ordained person who is not a bodhisattva, clearing up doubts concerning their destruction, and details regarding the ways in which they are destroyed. Regarding the first, there are three points. The actual topic, in engaging in bodhisattva contact, it says, what has been gathered in 1,000 eons, like giving an offering, offerings to those going to bliss, the Tathagatas, all those good deeds, whatever there is, an instant of anger destroys it all. Apparently, this was composed in accordance with Aryashura's work, Compendium of the Perfections. The play of Manjushri Sutra says that it destroys the virtue accumulated over 100 eons. With respect to the object, some explain that it must be a bodhisattva, whereas some assert that it is a general object. The the former accords with the commentary on the middle way, therefore, which says, therefore, through anger toward a child of the victors, the virtues from giving and discipline one has amassed over 100 eons is crushed in an instant. And the support, as regards the support of the one in whom anger arises, since even if a bodhisattva gets angry, it destroys his roots of virtue, there is no need to mention that this is the case for one who is not a bodhisattva who gets angry at a bodhisattva. In the explanation of Chandrakirti's commentary on the Middle Way, Madhyamaka Avatara, Tika Nama, it says that whether or not it is certain that the object is a bodhisattva, and whether or not the reason for the anger, seeing faults, is true, the destruction of virtue is similar to how it was explained above, and how they are destroyed even if the object of anger is an ordained person who is not a bodhisattva. In general, anger does not need to be directed at a bodhisattva in order for it to destroy roots of virtue. A passage quoted from the Sarvastivadin scripture in this compendium of training says, if a monk prostrates to a stupa of hair and nail relics with extended limbs and a pure mind, he will come to enjoy as many kingdoms of universal monarchs as there are particles of dust in the ground covered up to the golden foundation. Even those roots of virtue will be exhausted if he endures or disparages one of pure conduct. Therefore, if one should not even be angry at a charred log, how much less so at a body endowed with consciousness. Clearing up doubts concerning their destruction has two parts. doubts raised by scholars, their refutation. The first one, some scholars say that the meaning of the destruction of roots of virtue is that the potential of earlier virtue is to bring about its effect quickly is destroyed, and the emergence of its effect is delayed, so that the effect of hatred and so forth emerge first. However, if they meet with suitable conditions afterwards, it is not that their respective effects do not emerge. For if there is no mundane path whatsoever that can eliminate the seeds of the objects of abandonment, it is impossible for seeds to be eliminated by the mental afflictions. And their refutation has two points. The seed is uncertain. How destruction does not just mean postponement. Regarding the first, there are two points. How the effect does not arise due to conditions, even though its seed is still there. The reason that it is uncertain is because even though ordinary beings purify non-virtuous by means of a four opponent powers, their seeds are not abandoned. However, although the conditions are met later, it is impossible for the fully ripened effects to emerge. And second, even if the seed has not been abandoned, its effect is not produced once tolerance is achieved. Once the peak and tolerance levels of the path of preparation have been attained, although wrong views and the seeds of non-virtues that become the causes of the lower realms have not been abandoned, wrong views and reverts in the lower realms are impossible, even if these seeds meet with their conditions. And then how destruction does not just mean postponement has two parts, two points. The absurd consequence. According to the statement, what's heaviest in cyclic existence with karma, either in a virtuous or non-virtuous karma ripening sooner, can temporarily block the occasion for another karma to ripen and so forth. So this part of the effort is finished with Medalang Lamrim. Let's move to Lamrim Chemo, page 182. Chapter 13, page 182, How to Train in the Perfect Joyous Effort. This section has five parts. How joyous effort is, what joyous effort is, how to begin to practice it, the division of joyous effort, how to practice, and a summary. Regarding the first, when you have focused upon something virtuous, joyous effort is and to share some for it. Engaging in the bodhisattva deed says, what is joyous effort? It is delight in perseverance. The bodhisattva level explains it as a flawless state of mind that is enthusiastic about accumulating virtue and working for the welfare of living beings. Together with the physical, verbal, and mental activities, such as a state of mind motivates. Such a state of mind motivates. And the mental activity, such a state of mind motivates. How to begin the practice of joyous effort? Frequently reflect upon the benefits of joyous effort and the faults of not doing so, for you will develop joyous effort if you habituate yourself to this reflection. As to its benefits, the exhortation of the wholehearted resolve says, always rely upon noble joyous effort, which clears away all suffering and darkness, which is the basis of freedom from miserable realms, and which is praised by all the Buddhas. One who joyously perseveres has no difficulty accomplishing any project, whether mundane or supramundane, who among the learned is disheartened by joyous effort. Those who set forth for Buddha's enlightenment perceive the faults of lethargy and sleepiness, and then continually persevere with enthusiasm. So have I advised them. And also the ornament for the Mahayana Sutra says joyous effort is supreme among virtues. Based on it, you subsequently attain the rest. Through it, you immediately gain a supreme state of joy, as well as the mundane and supramundane attainments. With joyous effort, you attain the pleasures desired in life, become possessed of utter purity, are liberated, transcending the views of perishing aggregates, and reach Buddhahood, the supreme enlightenment. And also, one who has joyous effort is not brought down by prosperity, affliction, discouragement, or petty attainments. The Bodhisattva level as well says, because joyous effort alone, nothing else is the principal and highest cause for the correct attainment of a Bodhisattva's virtuous qualities, the Tathagatas have pointed it out, declaring, joyous effort is what brings about the attainment of unsurpassed perfect enlightenment. The Companion of the Perfections also states, if you are free of fatigue and have great joyous effort, there is nothing you cannot attain or accomplish. And also, even all non-human beings delight in helping you. You attain all types of meditative concentrations and spend all periods of day and night fruitfully. Your collection of good qualities does not decline, and your purposes, surpassing the affairs of humankind, flourish like the blue Utpala flower. As to the faults of not joyously persevering, the questions of Sagaramati Sutra states, the enlightenment of the lazy is exceedingly far off and distant. The lazy lack all perfections from generosity to wisdom. The lazy do not work for others' welfare. And mindfulness of the excellent teaching as well says, whoever has laziness, the single basis of the afflictions, whoever feels some laziness lacks all good qualities. Thus, if you lack joyous effort, you come under the influence of laziness and become poor in all qualities, so you lose every temporary and ultimate purposes of human being. The divisions of joyous effort has two parts, the actual division and the method of developing joyous effort. The actual divisions has three parts, armor-like joyous effort, joyous effort of gathering virtue, joyous effort of acting for the welfare of living beings. And so, with regard to the armor-like joyous effort, when Bodhisattva joyously persevere prior to actively engaging themselves, they put the armor of a preliminary enthusiastic thought, such as, for a trillion sets of three immeasurably great eons, each composed of days as long as 1,000 great eons, I shall not relinquish my practice of joyous effort. For the sake of relieving the suffering of a single living being, I would rejoice at remaining only as a hell being until I attain Buddhahood. As I assert myself in this manner for the sake of complete enlightenment, what need is there to mention my perseverance over a short period or in the face of lesser suffering? Such is the joyous perseverance that is like armor. A bodhisattva who produces even as an aspiration for or just faith in such joyous effort is steadfast. How much more so when one who is endowed with this perseverance, given that he or she develops measureless courses for joyously persevering for the sake of unsurpassed enlightenment. The Bodhisattva level says that for such a person, there is absolutely no action for the sake of others and for enlightenment to such a state of mind. It becomes the definite course of awakening for your potential for the Mahayana lineage, so train in it. Concerning armor-like joyous effort, the Compendium of the Perfections says, and it says, so we usually say that the tantric path is a swift path and take much delight in it, shows that we feel rather discouraged to think about the amount of time it takes through the tantric path. In a way, it reflects our laziness. And so Solanus was making comment on this last paragraph on the just before joyous effort of gathering virtue. After you have put on such an armor, you joyously persevere for two purposes: to gather virtue, and to act for the welfare of living beings. And next is joyous effort, gathering virtue. The joyous perseverance of gathering virtue is applying yourself to the practice of perfection in order to properly accomplish them. And then the joyous effort of acting for the welfare of beings. The joyous effort of acting for the welfare of living beings is properly applying yourself to the practice of the 11 activities for others' welfare. The next topic, the method of developing joyous effort. As explained above, since you produce, maintain, and increase all the virtues of the two collections in dependence upon joyous effort, the practice that develops it is very crucial. I shall discuss the system of the text of the great scholar and adept Shantideva. In Shantideva, engaging in the Bodhisattva deeds, noting that it is complete as well as easy to understand and to sustain in practice. The method of developing joyous effort has four parts: eliminating unfavorable conditions that prevent joyous effort, gathering the forces of the favorable conditions, favorable conditions based on the elimination of unfavorable conditions and the accumulation of favorable conditions, being intent on joyous effort and how to use joyous effort to make the mind and body serviceable. Eliminating the favorable conditions that prevent joyous effort has two parts. Identifying factors incompatible for joyous effort and employing the methods to eliminate the incompatible factors. The first one there are two factors incompatible with entering the path. Not entering even though you see that you can do the practice. And number two, not entering because you become discouraged, thinking, how can I do such a practice? Indeed, there is also not practicing because you are unconcerned with whether you are capable or not. But this is irrelevant here since this explanation is for those pursuing liberation. Within the first factor, there are two possibilities. You have the laziness of procrastination, thinking there is still time. And number two, you are not procrastinating, but you are overwhelmed by your attachment to inferior and common activities. In this vein, engaging the Bodhisattva deed says, the factors incompatible with joyous effort are said to be laziness, adhering to what is ignoble, and self-contempt out of discouragement. Causes for the production of laziness are indolence, attachment to the taste of inferior pleasures, craving the pleasure of sleep, and a lack of disenchantment with cyclic existence. Engaging the Bodhisattva deed states, laziness arises from craving based upon indolence, enjoyment of pleasure and sleep, and from a lack of disenchantment with the suffering of cyclic existence. Some assert that the first two lines indicate the form that laziness takes rather than its causes. And then next, employing the methods to eliminate incompatible factors has three parts. Stopping the laziness of procrastination, stopping the attachment to ignoble activities, and stopping discouragement or self-contempt. Stopping the laziness of procrastination is... regarding this, this involves the following three meditations. You contemplate that the body you have at present is rapidly disintegrating, that after that you will fall into miserable realms, and that it will be difficult to find an excellent life such as this one again. Meditation on these stops and stops the laziness that holds to the notion that there is plenty of time, thereby generating conviction in your mind that there is no time to spare. No time to lose. these three meditations were explained earlier in the section on the person of small capacity. And next, regarding the stopping attachment to ignoble activities, you see that the sublime teaching is a source of endless joy in this and future lives, and that you lose its great purpose when you are distracted in idle chatter and amusement, which are the source of much pointless suffering later. Meditate on this and stop your attachment. Engaging in the Bodhisattva deeds states, how could you abandon the source of the infinite joy, the highest and of pleasures, the sublime teaching, and the and delight in distractions and amusements that are the causes of suffering? And regarding stopping the discouragement or self-contempt, it is not enough just to delight in the sublime teaching after you have stopped your procrastination and your attachment to ignoble activities. You must train as a Mahayana practitioner. Therefore, if you become discouraged, thinking someone like me is unable to practice that, you must eliminate this discouragement. Stopping discouragement or self-contempt has three parts. Stopping discouragement about the goal, stopping discouragement about the means to attain the goal, and stopping it because wherever you are is a place of to practice. Regarding the first, the qualm, which if the goal is Buddhahood, the total elimination of all faults and the total completion of all good qualities, then since it is extremely difficult for me to accomplish even a few good qualities or to remove even a few faults, how could someone like me be capable of attaining such a result? Reply, if such a sense of discouragement manifests, it is very great fault. It is a very great fault because it constitutes giving up the spirit of enlightenment. Even if such a thought does not fully manifest, you must stop it as at its incipient stage. How to stop it? Encourage yourself with this thought. The Bhagwan, the authoritative person who speaks what is true and correct, never never what is false or erroneous, said that even flies, etc., will attain enlightenment. That being so, why should I not attain it so long as I do not give up persevering? Inasmuch as human birth gives me an excellent basis, and I have the mental capacity to analyze what to adopt and what to cast aside. Engaging in the Bodhisattva deeds says, how could I attain enlightenment? I shall not indulge in such discouragement for the truth declaring. Tathagata has spoken this truth. Even flies, mosquitoes, bees, and worms will attain unsurpassed enlightenment. So hard to attain once they generate the power of perseverance. Why should someone like me, born into the human race, recognizing benefit and harm, not attain enlightenment as long as I do not give up the bodhisattva deeds? Furthermore, stop your discouragement with this thought. In the past, there were former Buddhas. Now there are living Buddhas. And in the future, there will also be those who reached Buddhahood. It is not the case that just one person who has already become a Buddha accomplishes the path. Rather, those just like myself, gradually progressing upward, have become Buddhas and will become Buddhas. The Cloud of Jewel Sutra says, the Bodhisattvas think as follows. All the Tathagatas, Arhats, perfect Buddhas who have attained, who are attaining, and who will attain complete enlightenment will attain complete enlightenment through this kind of method, this kind of path, this kind of joyous effort. Thus, it is not the case that all that Tathagatas are, these Tathagatas are just one person who has already become a Tathagata attaining complete enlightenment. Rather, I too shall reach perfect, total perfection in utterly unsurpassed, perfect, and complete enlightenment with joyous effort in common with all living beings and joyous effort focused upon all living beings. I too shall seek and strive for enlightenment. The praise of infinite quality also says, even some who have earlier obtained the state of the Sugatas previously fell to states much lower than this one. Thinking thus, and in order to inspire us, you, Bhagavan, did not disparage yourself, even when you fell into the dreadful condition. To disparage oneself is wrong, causing those with well-developed faculties to become discouraged. As to this discouragement, since the Buddha's good qualities are infinite and results follow from causes, you must accomplish good qualities and remove faults through limitless avenues while on the path. After you have understood this well, you may become discouraged when you... Then take a look at yourself. However, this particular discouragement will never arise at a time like the present, when an erroneous understanding of the path is in operation. Now, when practicing to attain the limitless Buddha qualities, you suppose that they are achieved by one-sidedly pursuing just a single small portion of a quality and intensely working on it. Yet, in this case, your not getting discouraged is not a good sign. Rather, it is the result of your not being certain about how to proceed on the path or having a rough understanding but not putting it into practice, so you are confused by its apparent ease. For when you come up against the practice and receive an explanation on a fairly complete outline of the path, roughly arranged from the beginning to end, you say, if that much is needed, who could do it? And thoroughly give it up. Also, Sharava said, for bodhisattvas who have not engaged in practice, all the bodhisattvas' deeds seem easy, like looking at a target for arrows, and they do not even get discouraged. At present, we lack a complete practice of the teachings, so we have not even reached the level at which we would have discouragement or self-contempt. When we more fully appropriate the teaching, then there is great danger of discouragement and self-contempt. This is quite true. Stopping the discouragement about the means to attain the goal, the qualm, to accomplish Buddhahood, you have to give away your feet, hands, and etc., but I am not capable of such feats. Reply, you must bear suffering to that extent, for even those who live as they please without engaging the Bodhisattva deeds experience as they pass through cyclic existence unspeakable sufferings, such as having their bodies cut open, torn to pieces, stabbed, set on fire, and so forth, but they do not accomplish even their own welfare. The suffering occasioned by undergoing hardships for the sake of enlightenment is not even a fraction of this suffering, and also has the great purpose of accomplishing both your own and others' welfare. And then the quotation from Bodhisattva Charya Avatara. After that, with respect to giving away your body, you do not give it in the beginning when you are afraid, but through graduated training in generosity, you end your attachment to your body. Once you have increased the strength of your great compassion, you have no difficulty when you give it away, provided it is for a great purpose. Engaging the Bodhisattva deeds also states, and the supreme physician does not employ ordinary remedies such as those. He heals limitless chronic diseases with the most gentle treatment. At the beginning, the guide enjoins you to give vegetables and so forth. Later, after you are used to this, you gradually offer even your flesh. Once I come to conceive my body as being like a vegetable and so forth, what difficulty will there be in giving away such things as my flesh? Some say that since practitioners of the perfection of vehicle must give away their bodies and lives, they undergo torment and are on a path that is very difficult to follow. This text clearly refutes this, because you do not give away your body as long as you perceive it. You perceive it to be difficult deed, but rather do so once it becomes very easy, like giving a vegetable. Stopping discouragement, because wherever you are is a place of practice. Qualm, reaching Buddhahood requires taking limitless births, rebirths in cyclic existence, so I will be harmed by the suffering therein. I am not capable of such a thing. And reply, reflect as follows. Bodhisattvas have eliminated all sin. Therefore, sin's effects, the feeling of suffering, will not arise because they have stopped the cause. So we are far behind, actually. Through firm knowledge that cycling existence lacks an intrinsic nature, like a magician's illusion, they also have no mental suffering. Given that their physical and mental bliss increases, they have no reason to become disheartened, even though they are still in cycling existence. Engaging in the Bodhisattva deed says, since sin is eliminated, there is no suffering. Through knowledge, there is no lack of joy. Misconception and sin harm the mind and body. Through merit, the body is blissful. Through knowledge, the mind is too. Though remaining in cycling existence for others' welfare, why should the compassionate ones be disheartened? And also, thus, after mounting the stead of the enlightenment spirit, which dispels the dejection and fatigue, you proceed from joy to joy. What sensible person would become discouraged? So this verse is a favorite verse of His Holiness. Likewise, do not become discouraged even by being delayed in cyclic existence for an immeasurable length of time, because a long length of time is not in itself a reason to be disheartened. If suffering is extremely intense, even a brief period of it is disheartening. But if there is no suffering and you are happy, even a long time is not disheartening. Nagarjuna's precious garland states, when suffering, even a short time is hard to bear, what need mention a time that is long? But when free of suffering and joyful, what harms you over even endless time? What harms you even over even endless time? Bodhisattvas have no physical suffering. How could they have mental suffering? Out of compassion, they feel distress for the world. Thus, they remain for a long time. So, do not be discouraged, thinking Buddhahood is far away. Always strive at these collections so as to eliminate faults and gain good qualities. Also, since the completion of endless collections is not difficult, do not discourage yourself with the thought. To become a Buddha requires completing limitless collections of merit and sublime wisdom. This is so difficult that I could not possibly do it. First, motivate yourself with a desire to attain the goal of limitless Buddha qualities for the welfare of limitless beings who you intend to help. Next, focus on remaining in cyclic existence for a measureless period of time and take the Bodhisattva vows, thinking, I shall accomplish limitless collection. collections. Then as long as you keep the vows, whether you, your mind is distracted by other things or not, asleep or awake, you will constantly accumulate merit as vast as space. The precious garland states, just as in all directions, space, earth, water, fire, and wind are limitless, so we assert suffering beings are without limit. With compassion, the bodhisattvas extricate these limitless beings from suffering and then determine to set them in Buddhahood. Those remaining steadfast in this way properly make this commitment, and then, whether asleep or awake, and even when careless, they constantly accumulate merit as limitless as living beings, for beings are without limit. Because of the limitlessness of this, know that limitless Buddhahood is not hard to gain. Those who remain for an immeasurable time seek immeasurable enlightenment for the sake of immeasurable beings and accomplish immeasurable virtue. Hence, though enlightenment is measureless, how could they fail to attain it before long through a combination of those these four immeasurable ways? It is most wonderful thing if only I could attain Buddhahood in a brief time for the sake of living beings. Because you are moved by the very intense power of your love, compassion, and spirit of enlightenment. However, when you are not within the sphere of these motivations and you see the necessity of a long, very long training in endless deeds and that much hard work is required, you might think, if this is the case, who could possibly do it? If you should then claim that you are seeking a quick path, you directly damage the engaged spirit of enlightenment and indirectly damage the inspirational spirit of enlightenment. Your capacity for the Mahayana lane steadily weakens and your enlightenment fades into the remote distance. For you have utterly contradicted what Nagarjuna and Asanga determined to be the conqueror's own thought. So with regard to the pride, it is actually showing the pride which are to be cultivated and pride which are to be given up. So here, the pride is what has to be adopted or cultivated. So it's on page 198. Pride of afflictions means on page 198. Pride of afflictions means that with the contempt for the afflictions on all occasions, you think I shall be victorious over these. They shall never defeat me. It means being steadfast after you have generated the courageous thought to destroy the incompatible factors. Then some verses from the Bodhisattva Charya Avatara, and after that Sharava said, the happiness of those who cast aside the teaching does not exceed their happiness before doing so. Consider the fact that if you give up the teaching in this lifetime, you must hereafter undergo endless suffering. If you make no effort, the afflictions will not look upon you with compassion. Also, the remedy will not say, you are unable to cultivate me, so I will complete the task for you. Even the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas will not be able to protect you. If you apply the aforementioned prides, even great incompatible factors cannot block you, so you must generate these three kinds of pride. Engaging in Bodhisattva deeds says, against one who strives with pride, even great obstacles will not be in trouble. For so, with a steadfast mind, I will overcome my shortcomings. Otherwise, if practitioners are defeated by their shortcomings, their desire to conquer the afflictions of three realms will be an embarrassment among the learned. Developing the power of joy. Under the heading of developing the power of steadfast, the last sentences, train yourself until your mind is steadfast in the desire to finish everything to which you have committed yourself after you have carefully examined whether you can do it. The next topic is developing the power of joy. You develop the power of joy out of the power of aspiration. An intense yearning produces a joyous effort not previously present, and you have achieved the power of steadfastness, also called the power of pride, which causes the perseverance, that effort that has already developed, to be irreversible. The power of joy means that when you first engage in an activity, you do it joyfully, and once you have engaged, you have a sense of being insatiable in what that you do not want to discontinue the activity. With respect to how you develop this sense of insatiability, engaging in the bodhisattva deed says, like those who want the pleasure that results from play, bodhisattvas are passionate about any activity that they have to do. Insatiable, they take joy in their work. So strive with an attitude like that of children who engage in play without being satiated. That is, you must be just as insatiable about what causes pleasurable results as you are about the results themselves. For if ordinary persons strive, even when they are uncertain whether they will obtain a pleasant result, what need is there to speak about the activities which are certain to bear pleasurable results? Engaging in the bodhisattva deed states, even though they work for the sake of happiness, it is uncertain whether happiness will come. But as for those who work help itself is happiness, whose work itself is happiness, how can they be happy unless they work? So this is also the reason why being satiated is wrong. Engaging in the bodhisattva deeds, if I'm never satiated by sensual desires, which are like honey on a razor's edge, how could I be satiated with merit, whose fruition is happiness and peace? So develop an attitude of being insatiable, thinking indulging in sensual pleasures is like licking honey off the sharp blade of a razor. It is the resource of a little sweetness, but it slices up the tongue. If I cannot get enough of this experience, which gives me great suffering, for the sake of just a slight temporary pleasure, what sense could there be in feeling that I have had enough of the collections of merit and sublime wisdom, which give flawless infinite happiness, both immediate and long-term? Thus, in order to bring to completion the virtuous activities in which you have engaged, enter them as a sun-scorched elephant enters a pleasing lotus pond at noon. Try in this attitude and train in this attitude until you produce it. And then next topic is, based on the elimination of unfavorable conditions and the accumulation of favorable conditions, being intent on joyously persevering. After you have thus identified the three conditions unfavorable to the joyous perseverance, you attend to their remedies, you generate three powers. The power of aspiration, which is the favorable condition, for weakening those as yet unweakened unfavorable conditions, the power of steadfastness, which is the cause to not turning back once you have started, and the power of joy, which never wants to discontinue the activity once you have engaged in it. Through the power of relinquishment, you become adept at how to joyously persevere. At this point, you must develop the power of being intent on joyous effort. So I will explain this. As to how you are to act when you joyously persevere at eliminating what is to be eliminated, engaging with what the Sattva Deed states, as a seasoned warrior approaches a sword fight with an enemy, I shall parry the blows of the afflictions and strongly strike the afflictions, my enemies. So, just read on. And the next topic is how to use joyous effort to make the mind and body serviceable. So before that, Lama Tsongkhapa says, in summary, you must study and discern well what the Bodhisattva training requires you to adopt and cast aside, and then joyously persevere at continuously being mindful in all your conduct of what you have understood about what to adopt and what to cast aside. Hence, it is extremely important not to err about that at which you are to persevere. And then how to use joyous perseverance. Joyous effort to make mind and body serviceable. The method for using joyous effort to make the mind and body serviceable is the power of mastery. Sandideva sets forth in the chapter on conscientiousness in the Bodhisattva Charyavatara the necessity of learning the Bodhisattva trainings, the extremely grave consequences if you do not train in these once you have pledged to do so, how to regard the afflictions as an enemy, and the ways to generate the courage that looks upon the hardship of battling the afflictions as an ornament rather than as a burden. Meditate on these before taking up the task of training in the Bodhisattva deeds, thus stopping all the inhibitions that prevent you from using your body and mind for virtuous activities. Rise gladly to that task. And then next topic is this: how to practice. You must practice in any kind of joyous effort in association with the six premises and all six perfections. The generosity of joyous effort is establishing others in joyous effort. After you have stabilized yourself therein, the remaining perfections are in accord with the earlier explanation. A summary. Next topic is the summary. The recollection and cultivation of the spirit of enlightenment, the basis of the Bodhisattva deeds, inspires you to train in order to set all living beings in joyous effort. So steadily increase this spirit, and then aspire to and train in the methods of joyous effort. So on page 204, there's a question in the middle of the text. Well, how do those who want victory over their afflictions apply mindfulness and vigilance? And reply, you must concentrate, just as the engaging in the Bodhisattva deed says. A practitioner must be as concentrated as someone carrying a pot full of mustard oil who is fearful when a swordsman before him threatens to kill him if he spills a drop. Understand this from the scriptural statement with respect to the border region in the story of Gatayayana. While you are concentrating, if in general you should behave wrongly, or in particular you should experience the causes of laziness, such as sleepiness, etc., then you must not assent to them, but must confront and avert them. Engaging in the Bodhisattva deed states, thus, if a snake came onto your lap, you would hastily stand up. Just so, if sleepiness or indolence come, quickly avert them. Furthermore, do not merely discontinue faults, but actively feel displeasure at their having occurred. Contemplate as follows: because I proceeded in this way in the past, I have been wandering in cyclic existence up to now. In particular, it is especially blameworthy that I have taken the Bodhisattva vows and yet continue with these. With things that are incompatible with the vows, precepts, become inspired to henceforth restrain yourself, thinking, from now on, I shall make sure that this fault never occurs. Frequently employ both these attitudes. Engaging in the Bodhisattva deed says, whenever a fault occurs, I shall reproach myself and long ponder. By all means, I will do whatever it takes so that this shall never happen again. Strive at any deep causes that give rise to the continuous, any profound causes that give rise to the continuous, powerful mindfulness that is the root of this practice. Rely on such activities as keeping the company of excellent teachers and excellent companions, and broad learning, which are the causes of this powerful mindfulness. In this vein, Bodhisattva Charyavatara says, in any of these situations, I will practice mindfulness with this motive. Aspire to meet teachers, and engage in appropriate activities. In summary, you must study and discern well what the Bodhisattva training requires you to adopt and cast aside, etc. And next, how to use joyous effort or perseverance to make the mind and body serviceable. So engaging in the Bodhisattva deeds says, in order to have strength for everything, because engaging in any activity, I will recall the advice. Before engaging in any activity, I will recall the advice of conscientiousness and then gladly rise to the task. What form will the joyous perseverance produced by such efforts take? Reply, just as wind drives a piece of cotton to and fro, a joyful energy, enthused with virtue, controls your body and mind. When you act along with this energy, joyous effort is well established. Once you produce this, you will easily achieve all the collections. Engaging in the Bodhisattva deeds is just like cotton under the power of a wind that blows to and fro. So I will be driven by enthusiasm. In this way, I will accomplish all. Although such tasks are difficult, it is wrong to give them up. Rather, as the glorious Matrajeta praise in 150 verses says, you must make effort. The sublime state difficult to reach is not attained without hardship. Knowing this, you intensified your joyous perseverance without concern for yourself. So a summary of this chapter is finished. Page 207. Next, middle length Lamrim, page 187. The entity or how to train in joyous effort has three parts: the entity or the nature of joyous effort, its subdivisions, and how to generate joyous effort in one's continuum. And regarding the first, in Bodhisattva level, joyous effort is explained as a mind that delights strongly for the sake of gathering virtue and work for the welfare of sentient beings, as well as the actions of the three doors motivated by it. And its divisions, armor-like joyous. From the three, the first is armor-like joyous. When Bodhisattvas undertake joyous effort prior to applying themselves, they put on the armor of the thought that first delights the mind. That is, they delight, even if they are to attain Buddhahood, after abiding only in hell for 100,000 times or 10 million rounds of their immeasurable eons in order to eliminate the suffering of one single being. Also, with respect to putting in effort to attain complete enlightenment, they wear the armor of the thought, if I will not give up engaging in joyous effort for that length of time, what need is there to mention that I will not give it up if the time is less than that and if the suffering is less. And two, the joyous effort of gathering virtuous dharmas. The joyous effort of gathering virtuous dharmas is to apply oneself to them for the sake of accomplishing the six perfections. And third, the joyous effort of working for the welfare of sentient beings. The joyous effort of working for the welfare of sentient beings is similar to the above. And next topic, how to generate joyous effort in one's continuum. This has four points: the benefit of undertaking joyous effort, the disadvantages of not undertaking it, how to actually generate it, and how joyous effort is made to possess the six perfections. The benefit of undertaking joyous effort has two points. One will not be overcome by distraction and so forth, and will achieve two attainments. For ornament, for the Mahayana Sutra says, joyous effort is the best within virtue and so forth, as in Lamrim Chemo. And how those endowed with joyous effort, number two, not only develop these qualities, but also non-humans like them, In the Compendium of the Perfections, it also says, for him who has great joyous effort and does not dismay, there's nothing that can't be attained, that can't be accomplished. Also, all humans like to benefit him. He achieves all manners of samadhi. He passes days and nights with having results. He won't decline because of his mass of good qualities. Through aims more noble than concerns for humans of humans, he will flourish like an utpala flower. And next topic, the disadvantage of not undertaking joyous effort. The disadvantage of not taking joyous effort are described in the sutra requested by Sagaramathi. And also, mindfulness of excellent teachings says the one foundation of mental afflictions is laziness and so forth. And you should think like this. And next, how actually to generate joyous effort has 3 points. Adverse conditions for joyous effort. So when you see the samsara as like illusion, it does not make you feel despair about working to cultivate these qualities. So because of our clinging to the appearance of some true existence or objective existence of things, which we also in turn cling on to, thinking that the things have some objective existence, then this gives us displeasure, unhappiness. But when you see things as like illusion, it will not give rise to such an unhappiness. So relying on favorable conditions of joyous effort and how the body and mind become serviceable through joyous effort. Adverse conditions for joyous effort has 2 points. Seeing that one is able to accomplish virtuous dharmas but not engaging them, the discouragement that thinks, how could I ever accomplish anything like this? And so this part is finished, how to train in joyous effort. So next is Lam Rim Chamo, page 209, the perfection of meditative stabilization and wisdom. How to train in the perfection of meditative stabilization, the explanation of how to train in this perfection of stabilization has 5 parts, what meditative stabilization is. What meditative stabilization is, how to begin the cultivation of meditative stabilization, the divisions of meditative stabilization, how to practice, and a summary. And regarding the first, meditative stabilization is a virtuous one-pointed state of mind that stays fixed on its object of meditation without distraction to other things. And the quotation from Bodhisattva Levels. And then in quotation in... Engaging in the Bodhisattva deeds also says, having thus generated joyous effort, set your mind in meditative concentration. So, and then the second, how to begin cultivation of meditative stabilization, think over the benefits of cultivating this and the faults of not cultivating it. I will explain this in meditative serenity section. And the divisions of meditative stabilization. In line with the above citation from the Bodhisattva Levels, if you subdivide meditative stabilization according to nature, there are 2 kinds, mundane and supramundane. If you do so according to orientation, there are 3 kinds, If you subdivide it according to function, there are three types. Meditative stabilization that stabilizes the body and mind in bliss within the present life, that achieves good qualities and that carries out the welfare of living beings. The first meditative stabilization that stabilizes the body and mind in bliss within the present life is all meditative stabilizations that generate mental and physical pliancy when you enter in them with equipoise. The second is that achieves meditative stabilization that achieves good qualities is all meditative stabilizations which accomplish good qualities shared with Shravakas, the super knowledges, liberation, identities, totalities, masteries, and so forth, etc. The third stabilization, meditative stabilization that carries out the welfare of living beings is the meditative concentration which that accomplish the 11 activities for others' welfare. And how to practice? Whenever you practice any virtuous meditative concentration, you do so in association with the six supremacies and all six perfections. The generosity of meditative stabilization is maintaining meditative stabilization yourself and then establishing others in it. Understand the other perfections from the earlier explanations. A summary. And then how to train in perfection of wisdom has five parts. What wisdom is, how to begin the generation of wisdom, the divisions of wisdom, how to practice, and a summary. Regarding the first, in general, wisdom is what thoroughly discerns the ontological status of the object under analysis. But in this context, wisdom refers to proficiency in the five topics of knowledge and the like. The Bodhisattva level says, know that the Bodhisattva's wisdom is the thorough analysis of the phenomena that engages or has engaged all of what is to be known, and that operates through focusing on the five topics of knowledge: Buddhist knowledge, grammar, logic, technical arts, and medicine. Here, the wisdom that engages refers to wisdom prior to attainment of Bodhisattva levels. Wisdom that has engaged refers to wisdom after attaining such levels. And then how to begin the generation of wisdom. The way to begin the generation of wisdom is to contemplate the benefits of generating wisdom and the faults of not generating it, since I will explain the benefits and faults of having or lacking the wisdom of reality, selflessness, in this insight section. I will not elaborate on it here, but I will discuss the remaining types of wisdom a little. With respect to indicating wisdom's benefits, wisdom is the root of all good qualities for this and future lives. As the protector Nagarjuna's 100th verses on wisdom says, wisdom is the root of all good qualities, seen or not yet seen. To achieve both of these, embrace wisdom, the great source for what you seek, and for liberation is knowledge. So, esteeming it from the start, adhere to wisdom, the great mother. As the verse summary of the perfection of wisdom in 8,000 lines states, wisdom functions like an eye for the other five perfections, generosity and so etc. When the other perfections are completed by wisdom, they acquire their eye and fulfill their names, just as a painting may be complete except for the eyes. But until the eyes are drawn, no wage is obtained. How wisdom is necessary for other good qualities is illustrated by the example of a special piece of jewelry made of fine gold that becomes even more breathtaking when adorned with a precious emerald. Likewise, if the gold ornament of the five perfections from generosity to meditative concentration is adorned with wisdom, which is able to distinguish right from wrong, they become more magnificent because the wisdom makes them much purer. It is similarly to the way that the mental consciousness, by distinguishing the merits and the faults in the objects of five sensory faculties, the visual faculty, etc., causes you to engage in what is to be adopted or to reject what is to be cast aside. This is what the glorious Aryashura's compendium of the perfection, perfection says. Similarly, wisdom is also crucial for other faculties such as faith and so forth. When wisdom is present, as Lord, your generosity, faith, etc., understand well the merit of virtue and the faults of stinginess and so forth, so you become skilled at eliminating the afflictions and increasing good qualities. The compendium of perfection states, among the various faculties of faith and so on, wisdom is chief, as the mind is to the sensory faculties. With wisdom as Lord, you know what is a fault and what merit, so you are skilled in the methods of eliminating afflictions. Bodhisattvas depend on wisdom to purify the other five perfections, generosity, etc. Even when they give their flesh to someone who asks for it, they are unaffected by such thoughts as pride, discouragement, etc. It is as though they were taking a cutting from a medicinal plant. This is because their wisdom makes reality manifest. With a wisdom that sees the trouble of both cyclic existence and the peace of nirvana, they accomplish ethical discipline for the sake of others' welfare, so they practice pure ethical discipline. Through wisdom, they know the faults of impatience and the merits of patience, and they then discipline their minds so they are not overpowered by suffering and others' misperceptions of them. With wisdom, they understand well everything at which they joyously persevere, so their perseverance brings great success on the path, and through wisdom based on the reasoning, they accomplish the supreme delight and bliss of meditative concentration that is fixed upon the meaning of reality. The compendium of the perfection states, once bodhisattvas have opened the clear eye of wisdom, even when they give their own flesh without a thought, they never feel high or low about it, as if they were cutting a medicinal plant. And also, intelligent ones do not practice ethical discipline for their own aims. They see the flaws in the prison of cyclic existence and aspire to release the entire world from it. So, of course, they do not practice it for mundane aims. And also, injury done to the wise is not harmful because they possess the good quality of patience, like the best of very tamed elephants who are patient with many different tasks. Perseverance by itself ends in exhaustion. If aided by its ally, wisdom, it achieves great purpose. And also, how could the supreme delight and bliss of such meditative concentration be established in the minds of crude people who rely upon reasoning that has led them to a wrong path that is polluted by the great fault of accumulated errors? Two good qualities, which may appear to be mutually exclusive, prove to be non-contradictory for those who have wisdom. When bodhisattvas have become universal monarchs, with authority over the entire world, they still do not fall under the control of sensory objects. This is the power of having wisdom as a royal minister. Similarly, the bodhisattva's love that views living beings with affection is intense, but it is not mixed with even a trace of attachment, although they have a long-lasting and very forceful compassion. Compassion that cannot bear for living beings to suffer. They do not have the laziness of being overcome with distress and thereby lacking enthusiasm for virtue. They have immeasurable joy, but their minds are free of insatiability, which would distract them from their focus. And they are continually possessed of great impartiality, but they do not neglect for even a moment the welfare of all living beings. Wisdom does all this because it is what removes the impediments to achieve a balanced strength in these good qualities. Thus, the compendium of the perfection states, even bodhisattvas possessed of great kingdoms who have sensory objects similar to divine substances remain uncorrupted in their very nature. This is the power of having the virtue of wisdom as their minister. Their love, inseparable from helping others, is utterly free of stains from attachment. Their compassion, unable to bear for others to suffer, never succumbs to laziness due to the burden of distress. Possessed of supreme joy, they do not waver from the real. Their great impartiality never neglects the welfare of beings. Great wisdom removes all that would counteract these good qualities, and so it beautifies them. Matuchita's praise in honor of worthy one to of honor. also says, without rejecting the real nature, you are also in accord with the conventional. Thus, you do not have to forsake the real nature that gives great certainty that there is not even an atom of what your cognitive processes apprehend as signs of true existence. And you are also in accord with and do not contradict the conventional that gives deep certainty that effects arise from their respective internal and external causes and conditions. For others, these appear to totally exclude each other, but for those who have wisdom, there is incompatibility and lack of contradiction. The praise in honor of the worthy one of honor states, regarding your proscriptions and prohibitions, some of your word is definitive, while some of it is not, but between these there is no contradiction. The two facts that there are many dissimilarities in proscriptions and prohibitions between higher and lower vehicles and between Sutra and Tantra, and that there are all the practices of a single, and these are all the practices of a single person, are contradictory for those who are confused and lack the power of intelligence and seek the intended meaning of innumerable scriptures. Yet through wisdom the learned know that these are not mutually exclusive. These are limitless things that the unwise see as contradictory and the wise see as lacking contradiction. The presentations of the true truths and the many prescriptions in one scripture that are prohibitions in others and vice versa. To say that wisdom distinguishes the non-contradictory intended meaning behind them is the peerless praise of wisdom. In short, all qualities come from wisdom. And then the quotations from Compendium of Perfections and so forth. The faults of not having wisdom are as follows. Without wisdom, generosity and the other perfections are as if blind. And then consequently, generosity and other perfections do not become pure, and you do not find the correct view. And then another quotation. So, quotation from Compendium of Perfections. And on page 219 and 20, Sharawa said, until you become a Buddha, your studies are not finished. They are finished when you are a Buddha. And Gama was saying, thus, after that quotation, thus you must be convinced that wisdom and the study that causes it are indispensable for proper practice. Moreover, unless you reach certainty about the need for analytical meditation, when you practice, you will have a very hard time getting anywhere. So even some well-regarded scholars of the scriptural collections claim, understand study to be either a mere preliminary to practice or to be background support, like mountains at the back of a valley, but not the actual instructions. For this reason, you need practice to quickly attain Buddhahood and study to benefit the Buddha's teachings. This is contradictory in nonsense. There are just two kinds of teaching, teaching a scripture and teaching that has been put into practice. The former makes known the procedures for practice, and the latter is assimilating the practice after you have understood the procedures. Therefore, doing the practice without error is the best way to uphold the teaching. Moreover, unerringly upholding the teaching in the sense of practice depends upon an unerring understanding of scriptural teaching. Therefore, it is not right to forget what you have studied at the time of practice, for you must first know what first know many teachings and then put their very meaning into practice when the time comes to do so. Even if you do not understand the teachings from the outset, do not be discouraged, but strive to study them in accord with your mental capacity as much as feasible. Whether that be a little or a lot, do not make study and practice into separate things. Rather, the very thing that you practice must be exactly what you first study and reflect upon. Beginning bodhisattvas must depend with certainty on a single procedure of the path, a practice that is not biased towards one side, but is complete in all aspects of the path. When their mental capacity is small, they engage in conditioning themselves to just this process to study of study followed by practice. If their mental capacity is great, or though at first small, has become greater through conditioning, they steadily expand upon the very stage of the path that they know, proceeding in connection with all the scriptures and their stainless commentaries. There is no need for them to pursue something else to study besides these. Therefore, if instructions are accurate and complete, then, although summarized, all of the key points of the Sutra and Tantra paths and the paths of the higher and lower vehicles must be covered. Once they have been explained at length, you must be able to go through all the teachings. Until you reach something like this, it is possible to feel delight about just some portion of your practice, possible to feel practice, but it is impossible to become certain about the key points of practice for the complete corpus of the teachings. Consequently, rely upon excellent teachers and companions. Make a foundation of pure ethical discipline to which you commit yourself. Listen again and again to instructions. Do 4 sessions of meditation and then sustain the object of meditation and its subjective aspects. After you have made fervent supplications to the deities and gurus, strive at all the courses and of engaging from many perspectives in accumulating the collections and purifying obscurations. If you do this, you will become profoundly certain that the good qualities in your mind will steadily improve. As the former excellent beings say, make all the teachings you have previously heard completely clear in your mind. You must reflect upon them again and again, evaluate them and deliberate them on them. When you have let yourself forget the teachings, there is nothing gained by learning to stabilize your attention on one object of meditation. The best meditators are the best teachers. Mediocre meditators become mediocre teachers. You need knowledge of teaching, knowledge of the teaching and the commensurate meditation that both proceed to ever greater levels together. Once you gain a firm certainty from such reflection, you do not pay heed when bad friends say, all thoughts, virtuous and non-virtuous, are conceptualizations and are therefore to be eliminated. But rather think, the teachings do not say this, nor do my teachers assert it. Otherwise, if you are a person who possesses a little faith but no wisdom, you are like the leading edge of water running downhill. You go anywhere you are led. Taking anything said to be true, wanting to cry when you see others crying, wanting to laugh when you see others laugh. The divisions of the wisdom has 3 parts: wisdom that knows the ultimate, wisdom that knows conventional, and wisdom that knows how to act for the welfare of living beings. Wisdom that knows the ultimate cognizes the reality of selflessness either by means of a concept or indirect manner. Wisdom that knows the conventional is wisdom that is proficient at the 5 topics of knowledge. The ornament of the Mahayana Sutra states, without making effort at the 5 topics of knowledge, even supreme noble beings do not reach omniscience. So they must strive for these so as to refute others, to care for others, and to know everything. The topics are distinguished by different sorts of purposes for pursuing them. To refute those who do not believe in the teaching, you pursue knowledge of grammar and logic. To help those who do believe, you pursue knowledge of arts and medicine. To achieve the knowledge of all, you pursue Buddhist knowledge and so forth. So this chapter is finished. How to Train, middle length Lamrim, page 190, How to Train has three, in concentration, has 3 points. The entity of concentration, its subdivisions, and how to generate concentration in one's mind. Regarding the first, is a mind that abides in single-pointed concentration on any suitable virtuous object. And regarding the division, in terms of its entity, there are two. The mundane is a Brahmant. In terms of class, there are three. The class of karma abiding, the class of special insight, and the class that is the union of the two. When it is divided in terms of its function, there is the concentration that causes one to abide in physical and mental happiness in this life, and the concentration that manifestly accomplishes positive qualities, and the concentration that brings about the welfare of sentient beings. And regarding the first, this is the concentration that generates physical and mental pliancy as one places the mind in meditative equipoise. And the concentration that manifestly accomplishes positive qualities is the concentration that accomplishes the positive qualities shared with the hearers, such as clairvoyance, complete liberation, totalities, and masteries. The concentration that brings about the welfare of sentient beings is the concentration that accomplishes the welfare of in 11 ways by means of concentration. And next, how to generate concentration in one's continuum. The thoughts regarding the advantages and of cultivating meditative concentration and the disadvantages of not cultivating it will be explained in the chapter on calm abiding. The generosity of training in wisdom possessing the six perfections is to abide in concentration oneself and establish others in it. The remaining are as before. How to train in wisdom has 3 points, the entity of wisdom, the subdivisions, and how to generate it. So the entity, in general, wisdom is that which very thoroughly distinguishes the qualities in the things that is being investigated. Here is the wisdom that is skilled in the five sciences and so forth. Its subdivisions are of three, the wisdom realizing ultimate, the wisdom realizing conventionalities, and the wisdom realizing the welfare of sentient beings. And regarding the first, this is the wisdom examining the suchness that is self-existent by means of a meaning, generality, and the wisdom examining the suchness that is the self-existent by means of direct perceiver. The wisdom realizing conventionalities is that wisdom that is skilled in the five sciences, and the wisdom realizing the welfare of sentient beings consists in knowing how to accomplish without misdeeds the welfare of sentient beings in this and future lifetimes, and how to generate wisdom in one's continuum has 2 points. Advantage of generating it, this wisdom, and disadvantages of not generating wisdom. The advantage has 5 points. Its root is all positive qualities. It is the root of all positive qualities. Although the Bodhisattva gives his own flesh to someone who asks for it, like taking a leaf from a medicinal plant, it is not done with the discursive thoughts of pride, discouragement, and so forth, but is done with a direct perception of suchness by means of wisdom. By means of the wisdom seeing the problems of existence and peace, he practices ethics for the welfare of others, thereby purifying his ethics. By means of wisdom realizing the faults of impatience and positive qualities of patience, his mind is subdued, due to which he is not captivated by heretical practices and suffering. By means of wisdom, he understands the excellent basis that undertakes joyous effort and exerts himself in that, whereby there is great progress on the path. By means of the wisdom realizing on a process of reasoning, he achieves the supreme joyful bliss of the concentration that abides on the meaning of suchness. In this way, the complete purity of the five perfections, generosity and so forth, depends on wisdom. And then one endowed with wisdom can accomplish without contradiction even those actions that appear contradictory in common beings. And then next, the two truths are considered non-contradictory is also due to wisdom. next, permission and prohibitions are non-contradictory, also depends on wisdom. And the disadvantage of not generating wisdom has three points. The faults of being separated from wisdom, causes of wisdom, are, and so forth. How wisdom is made to possess the six perfections. And regarding the first, if they are separated from wisdom, the five, generosity and so forth, and view will not be pure. The Compendium of Perfections says, in those who strive for results in the absence of wisdom, the nature of giving is not completely pure. The giving, to give others welfare, is taught as the best of gifts. The rest are applications for increasing wealth. If wisdom's light does not dispel the darkness, one will not come to possess pure ethics. Mostly, that discipline, due to this absence of wisdom, will be disturbed by afflictions through a flawed understanding. Training the four means of God. Next comes at on page. We'll stop here. Training in the four means of gathering the disciples that ripens. So, chapter 15 in Lamrim Chemo. That helps to mature them. Sangye Shindo, make the Bewa Ye, Drogon Namda Shingla, Chebar Shu. Guru Radna Mandal Kamniyataya Mee.